Welcome to Oncology Today, key presentations from the 2025 ASCO Annual Meeting and the 2025 EHA Congress, Acute Myeloid Leukemia Edition. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Eunice Wang from the Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in Buffalo, New York. To begin, I asked Dr. Wang to provide her perspectives on the current use of the combination of a hypomethylating agent and venetoclax in the treatment of AML.
So since the approval of venetoclax azacitidine for treatment of older unfit AML patients, we've seen sort of a transformation and actually a shift in the care of acute myeloid patients globally. So as you know, Neil, in the past, when the only treatments for these patients were really 7+3 intensive chemotherapy, we were always told acute myeloid leukemia was a life-threatening diagnosis. Patients had to be admitted, seen in an academic center, admitted to the hospital. And you remember being hospitalized for 4, 6, even 8 weeks. In Europe, it's more like 8 to 10 weeks to get intensive chemotherapy with life-threatening consequences, cardiac failure, neutropenic sepsis, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we had for a time azacitidine alone and decitabine alone, which we sort of stole from our colleagues in MDS. But even those regimens really did not have the same efficacy as intensive chemotherapy and really were sort of akin to maybe giving them something before they went to hospice. So with the advent of venetoclax, which really brought up the response rates, intensive chemotherapy had a CR rate of like 60-70%. So with the advent of venetoclax, we're now having a regimen that had a CR/CRh rate of 67% in the absence of doing intensive chemotherapy. So it was actually equivalent, and it was being used in older unfit patients for whom we had already excluded as candidates for intensive chemotherapy. So this, number one, overnight sort of transformed our practices because we now could tell 70 or 80 year olds that they didn't have to start planning their own funeral and so forth, and that, you know, 2/3 of them were going to respond. And if they did respond, they'd only respond for a few months. We were able to say, we're able to get responses in 2/3 of these patients. And it doesn't matter if you have cardiac disease or you're 80 years old or you have, you know, pulmonary disease. So this really like doubled or really vastly increased the number of patients. But the issue with this is when venetoclax azacitidine was first given, it was given primarily in the inpatient setting. So we were able to transform these patients and open the therapies to these patients, but we had to do it in the inpatient setting. So now this has been so transformational. It's been so well tolerated. The reason that we did not offer this to younger patients was because we thought this was quote unquote like a second line therapy. But particularly with adding of things, this particularly targeted agents, we're like, well, you know, we started doing this just in 70 and 80 years old. The VLA trial, as you remember, Neil, was really for people 75 and above with comorbidities. But they also allowed some younger patients if they had some significant health issues. So then I started treating patients, well, let's do them 75. Well, you know, it's great. They're doing great. Why don't I offer it to people that are 70? So over time, it's been eroded. So now we're like, well, now they're like 65, but they're not a good 65. And then my staff comes, well, we have a 55-year-old patient and we just don't think they're going to do well with intensity. So gradually we've been saying, this is so well tolerated. We're offering it to younger and younger patients. And then there came some data showing, you know what, like, you know, when we take younger fit patients and we know we can't cure them with induction, we're trying to get them to transplant, which is their curative option. A lot of them weren't able to go because they develop neutropenic sepsis or we damage their heart with 7+3. So then for some of these patients, we said, well, you know what, maybe instead of giving them 7+3, we should give them this regimen. And so I think that that has been the evolution. And now we're at the point where we're saying, as our other therapies get better and better. And it's very akin to, I think, like acute lymphocytic leukemia, right? Everybody used to get intensive chemotherapy. Now we have immunotherapy, we have CARs, we have other things. So we've actually taken intensive chemotherapy off the table for many of our older patients with that disease. And I think we're in that trend where we are moving towards, as you saw from the presentation, even actually giving this highly effective AML therapy completely as an outpatient. And in some patients, if we add targeted therapy, even offering it to our young, why do we have to give the most toxic, barely well-tolerated therapy? Why do we say to you, you are so fit that we're going to beat you up and almost kill you to get rid of your leukemia? Why? Well, that's backwards. We should be looking at giving the least intense therapy for everybody. Just because you're fit doesn't mean I have to beat you up, right? I should be offering you the most effective therapy regardless of toxicity. And I think everybody would say, hey, if I can get the same results with less toxic therapy, even though I can tolerate the therapy, maybe I don't want it. You know what I mean?
So before we get more into this all oral regimen that you're talking about, just maybe bring back up, I think the most common question I've heard personally, I'm sure you also, since the advent of HMA venetoclax that I hear, particularly from community-based oncologists, is one, management of the initial cytopenias, particularly around a month after treatment, when to do another bone marrow, what to do at that point, and then how long to continue therapy. What's your kind of current approach to those two issues?
So my current approach in the original Valley A trial has really altered from the original Valley A trial. My approach to patients with venetoclax azacitidine is not to offer them 28 days of venetoclax during cycle one, but really to offer 21 days of venetoclax. I then perform a bone marrow biopsy, and if their disease is gone or the marrow is empty, there's no leukemia there, I don't give the following week. I allow patients to recover, sometimes even as an outpatient, and then I'll start the next round. But the most disease is really in cycle one. So if I've been able to clear it with 21 days, moving into cycle two, I then drop the venetoclax to like 14 days. And then moving forward, as they get subsequent cycles, I may reduce it back all the way down to 7 days. I may reduce the azacitidine dosing. But my feeling is that more, again, is not always better. There currently are a couple of clinical trials. One is just accrued, where patients are being randomized to receive 28 days, which is the label, versus 14 days to really determine whether maybe not 21 days, but even 14 days may be enough. Now, we do know that there's a lot of heterogeneity in our AML patients, but I think for the community doctor, it would be great to be able to say, if you have this and this mutation or this and this marker, that you can get away with less, right? Like, I don't give anybody 28 days. Everybody gets 21 days. And I'm going to look forward to the emerging data to see whether some patients may even just need 14 days. Because the management of the cytopenias at my academic center is not something to be ignored. I have the luxury to be able to bring a patient in, do a type and screen, transfuse them the same day. So my patients can get treatment 3 days a week. I have transfusion facilities on weekends, on holidays. That's not so in the community. So I'm looking at one of the advents moving forward would be delineating which patients need how much venetoclax as one, I think, practical measure moving forward. And that, I think, would relieve a huge burden on the community physicians that have limited transfusion abilities or resources. The second would be not having to have the patients come in every day for that HMA therapy and maybe moving to that oral regimen. So I think those two advances moving forward has the potential then to really move the care of these patients, maybe from academic centers more into the community, which is really where my patients want to be. And my current practice is that for that initial round, Neil, where they're getting transfused a lot, they're very dependent. I'm trying to make that decision 28 days, 21 days. We are doing that at our center. But once we've achieved a response and we've done that, then the great preference of my patients is to return to their home base and to have that therapy done as much as possible from their own home.
Yeah, we're seeing that strategy in a lot of situations now. I get the one that popped into my head is bispecifics and myeloma and lymphoma, where, again, often getting started in academic centers. You know, you went through the details of the all-oral regimen. Can you just kind of summarize that? And I'm kind of curious. I kind of feel like it's kind of been a long time coming. You know, as soon as I heard about oral decitabine, I'm like, oh, wow, this is going to be go into AML, and I don't know that it actually has happened up to now. Have you actually been able to do that, or do you need, is it as a result of this data and potentially an FDA approval that it's going to make that possible, or have you already been doing that?
Well, you know, oral decitabine cetrizoxazine really is approved for patients with high-risk MDS. And the difference is that when you infuse IV decitabine into a patient, generally it gets cleared very, very quickly because your body degrades the metabolites. And that's why it's important you have to come in daily to get azacitidine or decitabine, because it just is gone in your body. What happens is by adding linking the HMA to cetrizoxazine, which blocks the enzyme that's responsible for degradation, it allows you to take the oral and the HMA will hang around because it can't be degraded because of the corresponding cetrizoxazine. So there's been studies that have clearly shown when you alternate between IV and oral decitabine cetrizoxazine that you get a 97% of the same drug activity. So that was key, right? Because we having exactly the same pharmacokinetics is important, obviously, for the activity of those agents. And in terms of what I've been able to do is in my patients that have high-risk MDS, we're able to get it. There are some barriers. Even in my patients with high-risk MDS, this is an approved agent. The cost can be prohibitive, right? So some insurance companies will still require us to give sub-Q or IV HMA therapy because those are administered in our clinic. Those fall under a different, you know, prerogative. That will be 100% paid for. But when we move on to an oral drug like oral decitabine cetrizoxazine, the cost of that as a prescription is $10,000. So depending on the patient's insurance company, there are patients, insurance companies that say, no, just use the cheaper old HMAs. There's ones that say, sure, we'll pay for it, but there's a 20% copay, which is $2,000. So the patient will say, well, I'd love to get that Dr. Wang, but I can't afford the copay. And then there are patients for whom we're able to apply for grant funding that will pay for that $2,000 worth. And I can say universally, Neil, if there was not these economic and insurance barriers, I think I would be giving all my patients the oral HMA. There also are patients that can't get it because it's not officially approved as a combination strategy. So as we just talked about, it's difficult enough to get it for MDS. It's not officially FDA approved for AML. So then the insurance companies have even more justification to say we're not going to, there's no safety data with azacitidine, with venetoclax. We're not approving it. It's more expensive. You know, they're not committing to doing that endlessly. So that I think there still are some challenges. I do think that having the FDA actually approve the agent might be helpful and would encourage some of these insurance companies to be a little bit more thoughtful about allowing patients and covering it financially.
So let's move on to the increasingly fascinating area of targeted therapy of AML. And of course, now we have menin inhibitors included along with FLT3 and IDH inhibitors. One thing I just want to bring up before we start getting into the specifics for all that is something that I don't know, like I never can tell if I'm the last person to figure something out or maybe people, you know, from a global perspective, but I was watching a presentation that we were doing at one of the meetings on this, and all of a sudden it sort of hit me of the magnitude of the benefit that's seen with targeted therapy in general with AML, particularly when used in the upfront setting. And, you know, of course, as you know, we do education in all parts of oncology. So targeted therapy is used in so many different situations. We have situations like for me, when I think about targeted therapy, when I think about, for example, EGFR mutations or RET mutations and lung cancer, we see really exquisite responses to therapy for long periods of time. Other situations where targeted therapy is kind of like more borderline benefit. And just sort of globally, I guess I really, thinking all the way back to the initial trials looking at FLT3 inhibitors, midostaurin, even before that you were talking about sorafenib, the benefit of treatment seems like it's very significant, including a benefit on survival. Is that true? Is that your impression about it? And more globally, again, when you think about docs who are taking care of everything, putting that in context.
I think so. I mean, I think in the old days, we were only giving cytotoxic therapy. And I think, and you are correct, that I think that in the development of menin inhibitors, we're at that very early stage where we have a number of inhibitors that seem to be marginally, they are definitely effective, but only like maybe a little marginally better, 20 to 30% response rates, 4 to 6 months. But what we're seeing in combination is when you bring them forward in combination therapy, we may be able to treat the disease from the beginning. And as you know, with any cancer, your best chance of curing the disease is your first time out, right? Because once you get into third, fourth, fifth line therapy, yes, you're going to have agents that are be effective. But what one might say is you use the word marginally effective as you move down as they become resistant. So I think even in FLT3 inhibitors, when there are early days with FLT3 inhibitors, you know, midostaurin and quizartinib, they were of limited efficacy as single agents. I think midostaurin didn't even do anything. It led to some peripheral blast clearance and that was it. But in combination with 7+3, that was the first targeted therapy for AML. And that was many, many years ago, 2017. And I think that we've really are encouraged by these newer developments. We're talking like when we add in menin inhibitors, we add in NPM1 mutant, KMT rearranged, we add in IDH1 mutant, IDH2 mutant, and FLT3 mutant disease. That starts to become, you know, 2/3 of patients, more than half of AML patients are now going to have a targetable mutation. Okay. And if we move these targetable mutations into the upfront setting for everybody, that's the majority of AML patients. I mean, this was a group for several years ago that there was nothing that worked. And the feeling was that it was such an aggressive disease with such a short lifespan that there wasn't much that we could do. And I think that I agree. I think that we're at the beginning of the journey with the menin inhibitors. And I really look forward to seeing them being brought into the upfront therapy and us to see successive improvements to where they are going to be as established as FLT3 inhibitors for treatment of these patients.
And also with the definition of the target, it seems to be getting a lot more complicated. We'll get into that in a second. One other sort of global thing I wanted to ask you before we start getting into the specifics is the issue of MRD assays in AML in general, but also particularly with targeted therapy. A number of the trials that you described in your talk had MRD measurements as part of that. Where are we right now, both from a research perspective and, let's say, community-based practice perspective in terms of MRD assays in AML?
So I was actually just at a conference where the focus was, I think, 2/3 of the talk were discussing MRD for AML. So I think that there are a number of challenges, one of which we've already touched upon. AML is an incredibly diverse genetically and molecular heterogeneous disease. It's not one type of cancer. It's many little subtypes, and it's slicing the pie. And so when we're trying to develop an MRD marker, there is no universal MRD marker that encompasses all of patients that have AML. This is in contrast, I believe you mentioned multiple myeloma, which has an MRD assay, or acute lymphocytic leukemia that has an MRD assay. Those lymphoid-based diseases are much more homogeneous, and there are markers that are expressed in the majority of these patients, or clonal genotypes that are expressed that can be tracked successfully throughout the course of a patient and are broadly applicable. In AML, there's no FDA-approved MRD assay that's being used right now for AML management, and there doesn't appear to be any pending right now, because when you review the criteria being used by the FDA to approve these agents, they have to have multiple randomized phase 3 study, they have to have broad applicability, they have to have standardization of the assays. What we know is that using specific mutation, like for example, NPM1 mutant qPCR, or FLT3 ITD qPCR that has a sensitivity of 10 to the minus 6 does predict outcomes on our clinical trials. Many of these are kind of moving into early commercialization, but none of them are absolutely approved. So right now, I would say that we do use some MRD markers as a guide. They can be helpful. We do use them, but they're not commercially approved. And I think for people in the community, it's really, really hard to understand. So my recommendation in the past has been for some of these community physicians, maybe to partner with an academic center. And like, for example, the majority of the care to be given by the community. But then if you want to check to see how it's going, have the patient come every 3 months to the major center, have an MRD assay done at the academic center and interpretive, and have it be a collaboration between the academic center and saying, okay, per our testing, MRD negative, you're doing great, just continue on. Versus, well, we're getting a little bit concerned about this. We need to initiate some therapies. Maybe think about a transplant.
So let's get into specifics about targeted therapy, starting out with FLT3. First of all, can you kind of summarize right now your clinical approach to the younger and older patient with FLT3 mutations and how you approach selecting a FLT3 inhibitor?
Okay. So right now, what I do for patients off clinical trials is a younger fit patient is a FLT3 mutation. If they have a FLT3 ITD, my preference is to offer them quizartinib 7+3 based therapy and take them to transplant in the first complete remission. If they have a FLT3 TKD, or they have a contraindication that's saying underlying medications that can't be stopped because of QTC prolonging agents or some other contraindication to quizartinib, then they're getting FLT3 inhibition with midostaurin plus a 7+3 backbone and still going to ideally transplant in first CR. For patients that can't go to transplant, I'm continuing the FLT3 inhibitor during consolidation, and I'm continuing it as maintenance. For patients going to transplant, I check their MRD, as we just talked about, in our center using a FLT3 ITD MRD assay that's commercially available, and we are continuing those patients who are positive before or after transplant on a FLT3 inhibitor with gilteritinib for up to 2 years. For older patients, it's a little bit more challenging. I feel like there is no standard FLT3 inhibitor that's approved in the upfront setting for those patients. We do have a clinical trial where, and there is a clinical trial through MyeloMatch, where we're treating them with triplet, a FLT3 inhibitor, gilteritinib, ven, and aza in the upfront setting. For patients that are not eligible for clinical trial, they are going on ven-aza with a low threshold to potentially use gilteritinib in the relapse setting or the progressive setting if they have disease that that doesn't go away with that ven-aza approach. We also are, for patients who've overtly relapsed in that setting, maybe after quizartinib 7+3 or after midostaurin 7+3 or after ven-aza, we are very big proponents of using a triplet gilteritinib ven-aza in that setting, kind of like off-label, to try to get patients back into remission and potentially eligible for a transplant if they don't have one. And we're actively participating, as I said, in clinical trials. The other caveat I would say is that the FLT3 is often co-mutated with NMP1. And so it is also possible, if they're co-mutated with NMP1 and they failed upfront FLT3 inhibitor, to consider them for menin inhibitor trials targeting that particular mutation in addition to the FLT3. And we actually have a clinical trial now where we're combining a menin inhibitor plus a FLT3 inhibitor for people that are co-mutated in that relapse refractory setting. So what we do recommend in patients with all relapse disease is to get their next-gen sequencing panel repeated and see what they're potentially eligible for.
You mentioned that in the younger patient, you generally prefer quizartinib with 7+3 in patients with FLT3 in the ITD. What's driving your thought to use quizartinib as opposed to particularly midostaurin or even potentially gilteritinib?
Well, so I think gilteritinib is not approved in that setting. There are early trials from a gilteritinib 7+3 versus midostaurin 7+3 in the pre-ECOG data. And that study, we all think that gilteritinib is doing a little bit of a better job, but that study also used, as you mentioned, an MRD endpoint. So it looked at MRD negative responses with gilt 7+3 versus mito 7+3 after one cycle of therapy. And in early results, those were negative. So there was no clear advantage up till now for the gilteritinib over the midostaurin 7+3, and so gilteritinib is not approved in that setting. We also noted in those trials or previous trials that the gilteritinib 7+3 led to a long time for gout recovery, like in the 40-day range. So I'm not really using gilteritinib 7+3 aside from a clinical trial setting, because I think the data is still out there, whether it's really better. In terms of quizartinib midostaurin, we prefer quizartinib. We think that it's a much more potent inhibitor. When you look at the assay results, the quizartinib does have the side effect of the QTc prolongation, but it's actually very well tolerated as opposed to midostaurin. Midostaurin has a really noxious odor to it, and it is associated with a lot of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. I think there's studies that say up to a third of patients that stay on midostaurin discontinue the drug. So that those are other reasons why we would prefer the quizartinib if at all possible.
So you were talking about some data, which I find fascinating and a little bit confusing in terms of sort of going beyond FLT3 and looking at the mutational profile of who responds to these inhibitors. And I know it seems like kind of a crazy idea, but in a weird way, it sort of reminds me when we talk about PARP inhibitors and solid tumors that you can say talk about BRCA, but then there's all these other mutations. There's not clear exactly who would respond. And in PARP inhibitors, they actually have a global assay called the loss of heterozygosity, where they actually give a score looking at these non-BRCA mutations. I wonder if you could just sort of review what we know about co-mutations and predictions of benefit from FLT3 inhibitors, particularly quizartinib, which seems to be the one that there's a lot of research on in terms of predicting who benefits, and whether there's sort of an intuitive way to understand who benefits from these agents that we know at this point.
Yeah, so that's a great analogy. I think that that's a complicated answer. So in terms of who benefits from quizartinib, definitely patients that have FLT3 ITD, they benefit. Patients who have FLT3 TKD mutations do not benefit. And among the patients that have FLT3 ITD, there's even super responders, and those are patients that have co-mutations with NMP1 and DMNT3A or any of these epigenetic mutations like TET2. So there's a super responder ITD with some of those co-mutations. There's a non-responders of FLT3 TKDs. And then there's a potential for people who don't have any FLT3 mutations to potentially respond. And that's when we are really using your analogy of that loss of heterogeneity. So there actually is a particular gene expression profile that they've determined is predictive of response to quizartinib in patients that don't have FLT3 mutations. I've been told that it can be as few as 11 genes that might be able to predict this. In early studies, it seems like some of those genes might be NMP1 or maybe some KMT rearranged genes. So there is a certain gene expression profile. There is an assay being developed that's going to hopefully be commercialized or might be commercialized that's going to help us predict that. But just like you said, with the PARP inhibitor LOH assay, it really needs to be validated in the clinical trial. So the Quantum Wild trial, which is going to be looking at randomizing patients, regardless of their gene mutation profile or their gene profile, to get the drug or not, will be essential in terms of validating whether that particular panel is going to be something that moves into clinical practice. Obviously, you know, right now, if I'm not adding quizartinib to anybody that doesn't have a FLT3 mutation, because I don't have any idea, and then nobody does, whether that person would respond. So I would only really expose them to the potential side effects of quizartinib in the context of a clinical trial. But that suggests that, yeah, there might be a pile of people that don't even have a specific mutation that might benefit. So that would expand the pool. So there would be people that have FLT3 mutations, IDH1, IDH2, KMT rearrangements, NMP1, and a FLT3-like profile that might all be amenable to some type of targeted therapy. And that would be, by overwhelmingly, the majority of our AML patients in the future.
Really a fascinating possibility. So let's shift now. We're going to talk about IDH mutations and menin inhibitors as well. And just to, again, to take a little bit of a step back, I want to ask you, do you consider IDH inhibitors differentiating therapy? Would you use that term to describe that?
I think I would, because I think the underlying mechanism of their action is they release a block on the myeloid cells that allows the cells to get, who are stuck in that myeloblast stage, to evolve into neutrophils and then terminally die. So it's a very similar mechanism of action that we see in acute promyelocytic leukemia, but it is actually a mechanism of action, a common mechanism of action across multiple modalities that we know now are effective in AML. So for example, FLT3 inhibitors have been shown in a small percentage of patients to induce differentiation. The IDH inhibitors, both enasidenib and ivosidenib, as well as olutasidenib, all induce differentiation. And every single menin inhibitor that I have seen in clinical trial that has resulted in clinical activity also has induced a certain percentage of differentiation therapy. So I think it's a common mechanism. If we, you know, because we've tried for years, Neil, to kill these leukemia cells, we've higher, like we give, in order to kill these AML cells, the highest doses of chemotherapy administered across all of the cancer field, with the exception of transplant. In the transplant, we give doses because we don't care about eradicating the underlying stem cells. But among all the other tumors, you know, maybe sarcomas, we give the most toxic, highest doses, and we did that for years and it didn't work. So we have determined that actually differentiating agents is more effective than the most toxic chemo that patients can get.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you about menin. You already answered that question in terms of that being the primary mechanism. And I don't think you hear too much about differentiation therapy outside of AML. Maybe
I know,
I'm missing something,
unique.
But it's,
yeah.
But what effect, to me, you know, it's like, oh, it's that's the mechanism, whatever. It's another mechanism. But to me, this is, as you just pointed out, is so fundamentally different from almost every other systemic therapy we use in oncology. And so one of the questions I have before you get into the, you know, the whole issue of differentiation syndrome, for example, is do you think that the fact that these agents worked by actually causing differentiation provide sort of a hint about what the mechanism is to develop the disease in the first place?
Yeah, I think that's such a fascinating, intriguing idea that we really could spend many hours discussing. But yeah, I mean, this is a disease of the hematopoietic stem cell where something has gone fundamentally wrong. It could be many things. And the cell does not differentiate into a normal progenitor, but gets stuck somewhere along the way and then has some sort of signaling pathway or something go horribly awry that allows it to grow out of control. So I think it is, even from back decades ago when I was in medical school and beyond, when we first learned about acute leukemias, that was highlighted as the key, the crux of what goes wrong. And so it's not surprising to me that if we can unstick that differentiation block, that it would be applicable across the board, because I think that's the fundamental problem with all AML moving forward is it gets stuck.
So I don't know whether maybe you can answer this question, the differentiation syndrome that you see, as you mentioned, with APL, but now with IDH inhibitors and AML, now with menin inhibitors, you said sometimes with FLT3. In general, is the presentation pretty similar with these agents and management pretty similar? And I'm sure you see tons of people who've been managed by other docs as second opinions. Any misperceptions or things people do in practice that you wouldn't do in terms of a diagnosis and management of differentiation syndrome?
So in terms of differentiation syndrome, I feel like the differentiation syndrome that we are seeing with some of these novel targeted therapies is extremely different. So we're actually starting to name them differently. So there's like a menin differentiation syndrome and an APL differentiation syndrome and an IDH1, IDH2 differentiation syndrome. And I think that they are to some degree based, because all of these diseases are different, they have different clinical manifestations. Sure, they share some commonalities, a high white count, pleural effusions, etc. I do think that they do share some commonalities in terms of their clinical presentation and their underlying biology, but each of them is unique. For example, the differentiation syndrome that we see with IDH inhibitors tends to be something that can occur anywhere along the course of therapy. So it could be occurring 100 days later, 70 days later, 50 days later, obviously associated with fatal effects, but is something that can be fairly indolent. In contrast, with the menin inhibitors, we have seen acute elevations in white blood cell count doubling. We've seen white counts as high as 100,000 in patients. In fact, the ziftomenin clinical trials in KMT2A rearranged leukemias in patients that had underlying already extramedullary disease had to be halted because some patients developed acute differentiation syndrome. And almost all of the menin inhibitors have been associated with clinically significant differentiation syndrome. Bleximenib had a grade 5 event. Ziftomenib had a grade 5 event. And I think that was not because we weren't looking for it, but that it took us off guard. So I think with additional recognition and characterization and implementation of guidelines and really, I think, recognition, right? So now we're also aware of differentiation syndrome, that we're calling everything differentiation syndrome. So I've had to say to my staff, there's differentiation effects of therapy, and there also is the clinical differentiation syndrome. So I feel like we need to be cognizant that there are vast differences. We need to be able to manage. There needs to be treatment algorithms for our community colleagues as to be very clear as to manage them. Once we have instituted some of these approaches, we've really had very few fatal events. Okay. So I feel like we can manage it, but it really does need to be a little bit more specific.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a conceptually different toxicity. Again, you don't see this outside of AML, but in a way, it's similar to other toxicities. You have cytopenias, but there's all variations of the type of cytopenia. So I don't think it's really a new concept, but it is a very different type of toxicity. Let's talk a little bit about IDH inhibition, particularly the more recent Aluto agent that's come out. I see that you were part of a paper at the ASCO meeting just recently here in June. We see this a lot in oncology where you don't have direct comparison between agents. There was another paper we were talking about comparing different SERDs, for example, in breast cancer. But here we have two IDH inhibitors, olutasidenib and ivosidenib. And I see you did a part of this indirect comparison of these two agents. Can you talk a little bit globally right now about what we know about these two agents, the differences in efficacy and tolerability, and how you utilize them in your practice in younger and older patients?
All right. So olutasidenib is a newer generation inhibitor. It does have some chemical differences from ivosidenib. Both of them are focused on inhibiting mutant IDH1 from functioning to create that myeloid differentiation block. In terms of activity, they seem to have in vitro, I think that they've had similar efficacy. They both have similar ways that they inhibit the drug. But for whatever reason, when we use them clinically in patients that had mutant IDH1 mutant disease in the relapsed refractory setting, the olutasidenib seemed to consistently result and a longer duration of response, that patients were able to take the drug without evidence of activity for longer. Now, we don't understand 100% why. We do know that in ivosidenib-treated patients, that sometimes co-mutations in the RAS gene, so patients that have KRAS, NRAS, and IDH1, tend to be very resistant to ivosidenib and have shorter durations of response. We also know that over time, some of these patients treated with ivosidenib can actually develop IDH2 mutations, and that serves as another mechanism response. We don't have the same clarity of data with ivosidenib, I think partly because this is a very rare patient population. And I think the results of a comparison that was done that I participated in at the recent meeting was to try to take the results of all the available ivosidenib treated patients and compare them with the results of the fewer data with the olutasidenib. Because it's such a rare subset of AML, it's only about 5% of AML. Trying to parse and to really do a randomized control trial, I think, is going to be challenging. And because both of the drugs are approved, people can, you know, realistically, they can reach for one or the other. I think right now I use ivosidenib in the newly diagnosed setting. There's a lot of data with the AGILE trial that ivosidenib and azacitidine can result in about 60-70% of patients going into remission and is potentially preferred, I think, over using venetoclax azacitidine in a newly diagnosed IDH1 mutant patient because it's not associated with severe neutropenia and febrile infections, et cetera. It can be given in the outpatient setting, and it's extremely well tolerated. And I've had patients who remain on ivosidenib for several months, if not even a few years. And it's extremely, it's an extremely effective agent for the patients that it works in. I reserve olutasidenib for patients that have mutant disease in the relapse setting based on the data showing that it is a little bit more potent. You can see from the data that it doesn't seem to be affected by co-mutations. It doesn't seem to be affected by the number of prior therapies. But I think you're going to want to give your most effective targeted therapy first. And for patients that might have been exposed to prior IVO or even not exposed to prior IVO, maybe patients that had prior venetoclax, there is some data that suggests that if a patient as IDH1 mutant and gets prior venetoclax azacitidine and you give them IVO, it doesn't tend to respond. But there is emerging data that those patients may respond to olutasidenib. So because of all of those reasons, my first choice for a relapse patient is really olutasidenib. And my first choice for a newly diagnosed patient is really ivosidenib. So that's how I distinguish it at the current time. Olutasidenib does not have data in the newly diagnosed setting, but I know that they are doing those studies. And before I would use olutasidenib in the frontline setting, I would need to wait to at least see tolerability and some preliminary efficacy data. But obviously, yes, you know, the goal is always to use your best agent first. And so we'll have to see whether over the next period of time that gradually moves into the upfront setting as a better tolerated agent. In terms of side effects, the overall response rates were about the same. There is a little bit of differentiation with both, a little bit of QTC prolongation. I think there isn't, for me, a overwhelmingly different side effect profile that would lead me to choose one over the other.
So let's go on and talk about menin inhibitors. And maybe you could just talk a little bit about your own vision for how these agents work and summarize a bit about the clinical data we have right now, particularly for the FDA-approved revumenib, as well as the upcoming agents, particularly ziftomenib.
Okay, so these agents are really unique in that they don't target a specific mutation, but they actually target the transcription process that drives leukemogenesis. So there is this master epigenetic transcriptional complex that's based on the gene KMT2A, right? So in KMT2A range or MLL rearrange, there's a translocation between the AF9 or there's a translocation that occurs that places the KMT gene next to a partner gene. And there's like 80 different partner genes. And so the combination of the KMT2A with that partner gene leads to this master transcriptional complex that binds to the DNA and leads to upregulation of a whole host of genes that promote leukemogenesis. Okay. So it doesn't matter what your partner gene is. If you have that complex, you'll turn on not just one gene, but a whole array of genes that lead to a myeloid differentiation block that promote leukemic stem cell biology, that promote proliferation, et cetera. So that complex is the problem. We know that this is the underpinning of the disease in MLL leukemias for years, and there have been various things being tried to target that complex, okay? So what we discovered is instead of targeting the complex directly, what we could do is we could target a protein that is needed for the comp. So instead of targeting the complex, you can target menin. So the interaction between that KMT2A complex and the menin protein is needed for that complex to occur. The menin protein was initially identified in solid tumor patients that had multiple endocrine neoplasm, and it is a scaffold protein that brings together these transcriptional complexes with the DNA that allows the whole tumorigenesis process to occur. So if you block the protein-protein interaction between menin and the KMT2A process, you could prevent that whole entire complex and all of its downstream activities. So in patients that have KMT rearrangements, just you don't have to target that whole thing. You just target this one protein-protein interaction, and all of those gene transcription goes down, and then the leukemia cells actually differentiate and they terminally die, and the leukemic stem cells can't self-renew. And so it's a very potent mechanism. Now, how does it work in NPM1 mutant? So it turns out that when you look at the gene expression profile of NPM1 mutant disease, that mutant NPM1 interacts with a similar complex in NPM1 mutant that leads to similar gene expression as a KMT2A, okay? So the mutant NPM1 trigger works as like almost as an oncogene to trigger that process in those leukemias. And it turns out that that complex is still dependent on the menin-menin interaction. So in those patients, instead of targeting NPM1, you can again target that protein-protein interaction and have the same effects. So each of the small molecule inhibitors targets and binds the protein-protein pocket. There's a pocket by which menin binds to that complex, and all of the menin inhibitors bind that particular pocket interaction in different places. So each of the menin inhibitors had different binding capabilities. They also, each of the menin inhibitors have different pharmacokinetics, like some of them are twice a day, some of them are once a day. So revumenib, which is the one that's already approved, was approved for KMT2A rearranged. It's a twice a day drug and interacts with CYP3A. So it does interact with azole, so it needs to be dose reduced. And it has this pharmacokinetic property where it causes QTC prolongation. The dose-limiting toxicity of revumenib is not differentiation syndrome, which is the biological endpoint, but is actually QTC prolongation. So if it didn't have QTC prolongation, the dose of revumenib could potentially be much higher than it is right now, okay? So we know that revumenib works. It's very effective. The original patients treated with this drug were KMT-rearranged leukemias because that's the most documented. It is very effective. And there is activity now demonstrated in NPM1. So that drug is currently undergoing FDA approval to get an additional indication for NPM1 mutant disease. Okay, so the second drug, ziftomenib, is an inhibitor. It's a once a day. It targets a different pocket in that menin-menin interaction. And it's a once a day drug, does not have the CYP3A rearrangement, does not have the QTC prolongation. It obviously has a longer half-life, potentially better tissue penetration, which led to some more side effects in the KMT2A. And so because it may just be a sequential thing, why is it only indicated for NPM1? It's only indicated for NPM1, I think, because it was the second agent and the biology was more well-known, people enrolled NPM1 mutant patients. And there's many, many more NPM1 mutant patients in the population than there are KMT2A. And because revumenib already had the market and the approval for KMT2A, patients were enrolled on the ziftomenib were primarily NPM1 mutant. So it's not clear whether it preferentially works for NPM1 mutant, but that's where the majority of the trials were focused on. It may just be a sequential thing. That drug is up for FDA approval simultaneously with the addition of the NPM1 mutation indication for revumenib. These other drugs, fleximenib and another drug, enzomenib, and some other drugs that are coming out of China are what we call newer generation drugs. They've benefited from some of the knowledge that we've gained on the first generation, the first drugs. And they've also implemented, as you talked about a little bit, the strategies needed to mitigate that differentiation syndrome. So they are associated with less differentiation syndrome. And they have selectively been studied in those particular patient populations. So there is some early indication that they may have an improved response rate, maybe 10-15%, you know, as monotherapy. They have different side effects profiles. So where they're all going to end up, I'm not 100% sure. You know, when we look at FLT3 inhibitors. There's specific clinical scenarios for those. There's specific side effects. I'm sure you see this across oncology, that there's multiple bispecifics and myeloma. There's different EGFR inhibitors and CML. We have multiple BCR-ABL inhibitors. There's a place and they get approved for all of them. But where they fall out in the general practice is a little confusing, right? You would have to say. I think that we're going to have to wait and see a little bit what some of the studies show and where the approvals lie in terms of where each of the menin inhibitors is going to fit in our portfolio moving forward. I envision, however, that these are all going to be moving into the upfront setting. In the relapse refractory setting, we're going to need to know a little bit more about differentiating between the different inhibitors in terms of resistance that they have and in terms of are there inhibitors that are going to do better? Maybe we should start with one drug and then move to another drug, et cetera. I think that those information and those studies are going to need to still be done for us to really delineate where they're each going to fall.
So can you clarify right now exactly when and how you use revumenib? And also, if ziftomenib were approved, how would you utilize it there?
So I typically right now I use revumenib for my KMT2A rearranged patients in the relapse setting. Okay, I use it as monotherapy. There's discussion about their safety data with revumenib and venetoclax. So I know some of my colleagues, when they use the revumenib because of the low response rates, are kind of trying to sequence it with venetoclax or potentially even use it in combination with venetoclax. But definitely for KMT2A rearranged patients for which I don't have a clinical trial, that's where I'm reaching for it. In terms of ziftomenib, where would I use, and I think in right now, if I don't have ziftomenib, I would potentially use revumenib because it is commercially available. If and when zifto gets approved, I think my preference would be to move to that agent. I think the revumenib is a great agent, but it does require a little bit of like care, not a lot, but one needs to bring patients in for weekly EKGs. One has to dose reduce. One has to be careful about the azoles. It's a twice a day drug. Some of the patients have developed a lot of nausea and vomiting on it. And there's some cytopenias that have occurred, particularly in the post-transplant setting. Ziftomenib, which we've used on clinical trial, has a unique side effect. Some of our patients can develop itching, which really responds actually to gabapentin. But it's a once a day drug. There's not the same. And I don't know what the label will be, but it's a once-a-day drug. So my patients generally prefer that versus twice a day. Doesn't have the same nausea vomiting effects, doesn't have to be dose-reduced, doesn't have to have the EKGs. And more of my patient population is going to have a relapsed NPM1 mutation. So I do see that as just number-wise, something that I'm going to be reaching for a little bit more commonly. But what I really am hoping to do is to use these drugs more in the upfront setting, and then maybe with the newer drugs coming out, enzomenib and vlexomenib, kind of using them in as trials in the relapse setting until they're a little bit more established.
So final question, which is anything that we haven't talked about, particularly as it relates to menin inhibitors, there's just so much to say there, or anything else we've talked about that you want to add to what we've talked about today?
Well, I think I see some trends, as you mentioned. I think the all oral the fact that we could treat leukemia with a ven HMA based therapy in older patients as an outpatient or as a backbone for other therapy, potentially replacing intensive therapy, I think is really, really exciting. Getting rid of IV, making it oral, making it outpatient, incorporating targeted therapy. I think that I envision in the next 3 to 5 years, that's where we're going to be going. I see maybe us treating AML more as an outpatient setting in the community with these targeted agents. I see next-gen sequencing and precision medicine being a backbone of that. In order to incorporate all of these targeted therapies into our treatment of patients, we're going to need to have robust diagnostics to precisely determine in a very rapid way who has these mutations to use these agents. And as you mentioned very aptly, I think we're going to have to come up with some sort of, whether it's a number of different MRD assays for different subtypes of AML, or looking at some global MRD assay that's going to be able to guide our therapy. Because if we have patients that are taking agents or triplets or anything where we're getting 80 to 90% CR, it's going to be even more important to know who is MRD positive and who is MRD negative to determine, do they need a transplant? Do they need more therapy and the duration of that therapy?
This concludes our program. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. During the program, we may have discussed the use of treatments that are not approved, so please check out the package inserts for more. Special thanks to Dr. Wang, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.